This conference will now be recorded.
And with Dr. Slimp on, do you mind to let her chat for just a minute?
Absolutely.
Dr. Costello, do you mind to unmute that for Dr. Slimp? There we go.
We're set. Thanks. I'm just excited to be here with all of you and to learn with you today. So I'm sitting in and listening and learning. I'm excited that you all are thinking about how to do this across the system. And we'll partner with you however it's best to get information out as you evolve it. If I come in and out, it's because we're actually trying to get some PPE out momentarily that just came in. So if I disappear, it's just for that purpose, but I'll be right back with you.
Dr. Slim, thanks for all you're doing. I can't imagine the job and the task that you guys have right now, but try to keep some time for yourself to get some sleep and rest. You know?
Thanks. I look, this is great that we're doing this more, though. So I love hearing from folks and learning together and making sure we have a coordinated response. It's definitely a team effort.
Danny, 602, you want to, Dr. Slimp, would you want to just do a quick address of where you are, where the state is? I was just going to share some of our experiences on the intensivist kind of side and discussions I've had with other groups. That's was going to be the bulk of what I was going to kind of update, and then mostly just a discussion for the state, but Would you want to just
sure.
give an update?
Sure. You know, in terms of where we are in terms of cases, the preliminary numbers I'm seeing for today are around 110 positives, which is an increase of about 34 folks. We actually are seeing increased testing happening. We've had at least 2,400, 2,500 people tested and results come back. We know there's more folks that are out there that have been tested and the results are pending from the laboratories. You know, LabCorp takes a little while, that kind of thing. As much as we can work to expand our clinical testing diagnostic capability across the state through hospitals, which have faster turnaround times than the commercial laboratories currently, the better. So if your hospitals are interested and willing and able to think about adding this capacity to their testing realm, that would be great. You know, I think we are at the reality of testing and case contact investigation and outbreak management is really critical to the response. And we're really ramping up ability to do those things. But we don't do that in the absence of really maximizing the mitigation piece. And so I think anything that we can do, the key thing right now, we're at such a critical kind of point in our community mitigation and spread, that the key thing is really getting folks to do that physical distancing. And if they are sick, to stay home. So in terms of how to really, if they are sick, to pretend as if you had it and manage it appropriately, as I'm thinking. But I'd love some feedback on what you all are thinking with that at the community level. We do know that the virus seems to be, the viral shed seems to be highest right around the time of symptom onset, and maybe even a day or two before. Unlike traditional SARS, where the viral shedding was more several days after onset. So that may be part of what's causing the spread to be so rapid. Is that's really when that viral load is high, is right around the time of symptom onset or a day or two before. So that's part of the discussion around how do we best mitigate by separating folks now, keep people that are sick home now. So I'm going to stop there and turn it over back to Tom. I look forward to learning with all of you.
Thanks for the info. I have some kiddos that are heading out the door, so I was just telling them about it. What about Darcy, in terms of the community sites, you know, we still get, I'm sure there's a lot of primary care folks online right now that are still asking about when they get calls and where do they direct their patients. I know we have Thomas trying to set up here in Charleston. We have Taze Valley setting up. We have the across the Chesterfield Avenue here in Charleston, but what about across the rest of the state?
Tom, we're having some video. There was a lot of feedback. I couldn't quite hear the full question.
So the question would just be about community test sites. So those that aren't critical enough to come to the hospital, but are those sites being put up or published around the state so people know where to send people?
Yeah, they are. And there's actually a map of those that I think you can link to from our website now. It's we link to a WVU website that does that. We've got reports of at least 150 places from which we've had specimens being submitted, everything from individual clinics to community test sites. So they are expanding in communities with that.
Well, Danny, it is about 6:06. I was going to get, you want to go ahead and get started?
You go right ahead, sir. You're the guy this time, so I don't have anything else that I need to say. I'm happy for Dr. Costello and Dr. Slimp being here to help answer questions for us here, but go right ahead into your presentation, sir.
First of all, I'd like to say thanks to State Medical for getting all the docs together. I think this is really helpful. It's a shame that it takes a crisis for us to probably do this and do it and not do it more often for a variety of things, but this has been very important. I do want to say that I have nothing to disclose. Anything that I talk about is just purely anecdotal. It's from a practice standpoint. And we will take, any questions along the way. They ask that you text those on the phone or those that are on your computer. There's a little text bubble there at the top right-hand corner. So if you have questions, just to keep the chatter down, and everybody's dogs in the background, et cetera, just hit those questions and we'll try to fill those. Or if you just have comments that you want to add. Here in Charleston, I just want to go over a few quick details. Most of us have been following this pretty closely. We've been reading on the news, the internet, or medical society web pages. So I don't want to bore you with a lot of stuff that you already know. But our experience here in Charleston's probably been about the same that we've seen across the state. CMC's had a total of 5 cases. 4 of those was on our service. Out of those, 2 had to be intubated. The first case we had was a 37-year-old, young, healthy male, same thing that you hear, went to a funeral in Michigan, came back and felt great. And actually felt well for about 10 days and was going to work, et cetera. Was completely asymptomatic before he started developing symptoms. Actually went to the emergency department, did not meet criteria at the time, was turned away, continued to have respiratory distress, went back on a Friday evening, was at that point very febrile, short of breath, and again, young, healthy 37-year-old. Quickly recognized that he was possibly COVID. He was tested. He was transferred to the intensive care unit at CMC. We took him. His CAT scan looked like he had metastatic lung disease. I mean, he had nodular diffuse bilateral infiltrates, very large nodule to the point that, again, it almost looked like metastatic disease, like little golf balls throughout. So we were very concerned about him. He quickly was de-escalating, went up to about 6 liters, was maintaining SATs only in the low 90s. Now, the treatment that we did was the kind of novel treatment. You know, as you all know, there's no true well-done studies on this. It's more anecdotal and short kind of case studies that have been performed, one in China, a couple in France, I believe. But they've looked at hydroxychloroquine. They looked at Zithromax. They looked, you know, of course, there's been other things about convalescent serums and interleukin-6 inhibitors. But we placed our patient on what we kind of found was what had been used out in Seattle, what Stanford had released, John Hopkins. But we did hydroxychloroquine or Plaquenil, 400 milligram BID for the first day and then a 200 milligram BID for the next 4 days. And that's the protocol that we chose to go with. We also placed him on zithromycin, and he turned around really well within 24 hours or so, along with the aggressive hydration. He had gone from 6 liters back down to 3 liters, maintaining SATs, and that was Friday of last week. So he was actually being discharged today, doing well back to room air. So the question, what turned him around, was it the anti-inflammatory, potential antiviral effects of those medications, or just good hydration, or he's just lucky enough to be young and healthy, probably a combination maybe of all the above. But that raised the question for us is, you know, are we doing the right thing? Are we doing the best medicine that we know of as providers? And furthermore, we had concerns, or I had concerns from other physicians around the state, that what happens if the surge does hit West Virginia and the big, more tertiary centers are full and smaller hospitals are forced to admit and take care of these, even complexly ventilate these patients. And so I got on the horn with some of my colleagues at Morgantown, Dr. Stephen Hoffman, who was their COVID captain up at WVU, and Dr. Kawaja in Huntington, who's head of Marshall's program. And we all kind of just traded notes, and it was kind of amazing to me. We were all pretty much on the same line, which is kind of dividing the patients into three categories, either the pretty healthy, doing okay, minimal symptoms, some moderate in between, which was more like the individual that I just posed that we took care of last Friday, and then the more critical patients that are requiring mechanical ventilation. So I think we were all in pretty universal agreement that it's certainly worth a try to use the Plaquenil and the Zithromycin. Only time will tell if that was the right thing to do for these patients. But they're fairly benign treatments, especially when you're talking about short durations. You know, we use Plaquenil in the pulmonary world, especially when patients have certain interstitial lung diseases. They can't tolerate immunosuppressants. Like prednisone for other reasons. But we're only talking about a 5-day course, which is what we're all looking at, maybe a little more extensive if somebody is really critically ill. But our dosing, our regimens were pretty much dead on. And so those will be available. WVU's got about a 4-page protocol for adults. It was very similar to a nuts and bolts, about 2-page protocol we put together at CMC, and it was right on line with what they were doing with Marshall. So those can be available to anybody that wants them. Let us know afterwards, and I'll make sure that we email you copies, PDF copies of those. The experiences at Morgantown was very similar. One thing that I thought was interesting, though, was they talked about a patient they had that was a congestive heart failure patient that was also COVID positive, and they treated the patient more as congestive heart failure. They just so happen to have COVID versus the opposite. We all know that COVID infections can cause cardiomyopathies and more prone to be more have morbidity in patients with known heart disease. But they didn't start the patient on Plaquenil or Azithromycin. They treated the congestive heart failure, and the patient apparently did well. And as of Thursday night, they thought that he would be off the ventilator shortly, with just a few days of aggressive CHF management. So I haven't heard how that one turned out. I hope it turned out well. You know, in terms of our numbers here in West Virginia, you know, I was just kind of looking at CMC's website. We've had a total, at least there's a little delay, but it looks like about 678 tested at CMC with 16 positive. Now that's about a 2.4%. Dr. Slint can speak better than me, but I was looking at the DHHR website just before we got online, and it was posting 76 positive tests with 1855. So this may need a little updating, but that's about a 4.1%. So I think we're falling right in line with what you're seeing published other places, somewhere in that 3%. We're between the CMC and West Virginia numbers, which I'm sure CMC numbers are included in that West Virginia number, but 2 to 4% positive range. I think it is interesting to note for the providers out there that may have not seen these patients yet, just again anecdotally talking to my colleagues and what they've heard. You know, they've got colleagues throughout the country. It's kind of funny that they say that a lot of patients do seem to be presenting with loss of smell and taste as some of their initial symptoms, even before they start feeling bad with sore throat, cough, fever. I haven't seen that a lot. I've just heard that from several physicians who's talked to their colleagues that are in other parts of the country that have dealt with this more so than what we have here in West Virginia. It's also interesting that a lot of times they don't have fever, which again explains why this thing is so contagious. Now, 90%+ once they get admitted. We usually pop a fever at some point. But at presentation to the hospital, oftentimes those that are positive do not have fever. The other thing I'd point out is, you know, in one of the concerns we had early on was, what about the potential for cross-infection? So, in other words, you have multiple things at the same time. I know we've been seeing that a lot with flu. You know, people have talked a lot about COVID, but flu kills people too. Just at CMC, we lost a CRNA just a couple of weeks ago, a 37-year-old, prior healthy CRNA from complications from flu. Two Saturdays ago, intubated a 27 and a 60-year-old from flu. We lost a 30-year-old earlier, just right before the legislative session, early January, from complications from flu. I believe WVU and Dr. Costello can probably speak to that. I think I heard you guys lost a child with flu this year. So we're very concerned with that. But what we were seeing a lot with our flu patients is a lot of cross-infections with other viruses, and especially bacteria, Klebsiella, Haemophilus influenza. Now, in China, I know they were only 5 to 10% is what I've heard. The reports came out that people were, had co-infections. The Stanford literature that has been posted talked more around the 20% range. I know the two that we intubated day before yesterday, both were co-infected, one with rhinovirus and one with the coronavirus. So just to keep that in mind, if you have the availability in your hospitals and they are positive and they don't seem to be responded, or perhaps they're sicker than that, I don't know if that's a standard protocol now that everybody's getting COVID tested, since it is seems to be hitting West Virginia finally. But and I'm certainly not encouraging everybody to go test everybody with COVID, but certainly keep that in the back of your mind. The only other thing I would kind of point out that I thought was interesting, one of the docs sent Director Scalise some interesting data. And Dr. Slimp, I don't know if you've had a chance to even look at this yet, but the COVID-19 healthdata.org, but it was just some computer models across the state or across the country. And it was interesting. It looked like, or these models that was in this site predicted that there would be a peak in the U.S. around April 14th. I know a lot of, in our office and colleagues that I've spoken with, you know, we're concerned. When are we going to get back to business as usual? And so this model predicted a peak in the U.S. around April 14th. And at that point, this model predicted 100,000 beds would be required and a 49,000 shortage, 34,700 ICUs beds that would be required with a 14,000 shortage, over 18,700 ventilators that would be required. And on that day, April 13th, there would be a projected 2,341 deaths that day alone, with the total kind of finishing out at about 81,000 deaths by August 3rd of this year. Now that they extrapolated each state, and West Virginia's numbers look quite a bit better than that. But I did find it interesting that it didn't forecast us having a peak until April 26th, and that we would need a total of 1,400 beds, 212 ICU admissions, and that we would only be falling about 16 ICU beds short. You know, we can easily make up 16 ICU beds across the state, 114 ventilators that would be required, with on April 22nd, when we were peaking, 14 deaths that day. And by August 3rd, West Virginia would have sustained 460 projected deaths from COVID. I don't know if you've got, Dr. Slimp, any other computer models. I would imagine that this is probably more of a worst-case scenario than maybe what's really expected. And hopefully with what good folks are doing at DHHR, these numbers will be much, much, much lower. But the promising thing as an intensivist is, if this is the worst case scenario, I think we should be able to manage this. Talking with, my colleagues at WVU and Marshall, we have all been putting side plans into place where if we had to, make more ICU beds, step downs, et cetera. My biggest concern would be flow. Of course, the nursing homes don't want to take these patients. The skilled nursing units don't want to take these patients. And so if we see a big surge here in West Virginia, I would imagine the vast majority of patients that are admitted are not really going to require ICU, but require more acute care beds. And so my biggest fear is that we would have a scenario where we'd have 8 or 9 patients in the ER on ventilators that need ICU beds. We have patients that have stabilized and can be transferred out of the ICU, but there's just simply no beds to put them in because the skilled nursing units, the SNFs, the aren't taking patients because they're COVID positive, and there's just nowhere to place those. But if this is worst case scenario, it looks like it can be manageable. With all that being said, that's kind of my spiel. It looks like there are a bunch of questions, and I think that probably I'll just read these off and post them here. The first one is from Dr. Pollard that asks, when can we expect to get the N95 masks? And I'll defer that to Dr. Slimp, if that's okay.
The popular question, let me tell you, and I understand it. So we are getting them in chunks, and so we're trying to just move them out in chunks as they come, so rather than hold on to anything. So we just had a shipment today come in, and we were getting those out tomorrow. We're trying to distribute it across. So for our hospitals, they will come straight to hospital. They're all getting delivered through health. The National Guard is delivering them, but there's a box for hospitals, and then there's a box for other entities in the community, and some guidance around use of that. So those will go to local health departments, is my understanding, that will work with you all in the community if you're in an outpatient setting, to distribute those across long-term care. And that's an area that we probably need to prioritize some at the moment, what we're seeing. But so long-term care, primary care, hemodialysis, behavioral health, we're trying to try to put that across the system. So you'll see some come out in the next day or two. But again, it is not going to be the full supply. We're just sending it out as it comes in to distribute it.
Okay. We have another question here. It says, what do you comment regarding Motrin and Advil? I think there's been, when we spoke about algorithms, what to do in the hospital, there were some kind of universal things. One, try to stay away from BiPAPs. Patients go on oxygen once they get up to about 6 to 8 liters if they continue to decompensate. I know JAMA just came out yesterday with some recommendations that said you could try OptiFlow, high-flow oxygen. Things that we're hearing in WVU and Marshall had kind of agreed on is to try to stay away from the BiPAPs and go straight to intubation. But there's other things such as like trying to cut down on ancillary services. So keep patients out of the CAT scanners, try to not contaminate your departments as much as possible. Don't do echoes, EKGs, et cetera, unless really needed. Now, of course, if you got patients on Plaquenil and zithromycin and other agents, you may have to be doing daily EKGs because of QTC. Now, the two patients that we have on the ventilator, I will say both their QTCs jumped pretty quick, and the zithromycin is what we decided to pull off. You can always use doxycycline if you're still worried about atypical co-infection, but try to cut down on ancillary services just to try to decrease and conserve your PPE and contamination of your staff. One of my partners trained in Arizona, and he called out there, and they actually have committed to only one physical exam a day. So whoever the attending physician is the exam that all other physicians, unless something changes in the clinical picture that they feel that the patient has to be reexamined, all clinicians, other consultants, use that one exam to try to limit the amount of exposures and maintain PPE. In terms of the aspirin Motrin, I think I heard on, and again, all this stuff's anecdotal while I'm listening like you guys are, but they've kind of fallen away from that. They're not pressing a big deal about that. There is a higher rate of renal failure on these patients that get infected. But there are some mechanisms in the lungs where they thought this may allow a pathway when you use NSAIDs. I think the populace has kind of fallen away from that, not making a big deal about it. There's also the question about ACE inhibitors. There's also another mechanism there, but again, I think that's kind of falling out of favor. I don't know so much if that's just because so many patients are on ACE inhibitors, but I think it's one of those clinical judgments that you use. There are some questions on here asking for the copies of the algorithms, and we'll certainly get those out to everybody. If you just, Danny, I think you guys can be watching for those, and whoever requests those, we can certainly get you out a copy, or maybe even just post those on your website for people to be able to download like a PDF.
We can do that, sir.
Yeah, Dr. Jacobo, we actually are working with the three groups, and we've compiled all the guidelines into one document, including with a consultation of infectious disease. So the document will have testing recommendations as well as the treatment guidelines that the major medical centers have decided to follow. And so we're just getting that kind of proof through different experts and approval. And the hope would be is that we can distribute that comprehensive guide to this group, and it would also then be posted on various websites just to try to have comprehensive guidance. We thought that might be helpful. There's been a lot of questions about testing and IDs input as well. So that was what we've been working on today. And I'll have a draft to you, Dr. Jacobo, here too. And so we can get that out to the larger group here shortly.
That'll be great. Thanks, Dr. Sella, for that. The other thing I would like to say too is when I spoke with the other the groups, if the situation does occur, regardless of where you are or what hospital you may be at, you may not have ID or pulmonary intensivist. And so everybody was on the same page that if you have questions, don't feel left out. One of the things we wanted to make sure that every provider in West Virginia had was access to the people that they need. And so the WVU system, I think they're covering about 17 hospitals. They're trying to set up an electric or a tele-ICU to help manage that. But also they have the MARS line. So feel free to call that line. They'll put you in touch with one of their intensivists or ID you, depending on the question you have. And they'll be glad to help you through any clinical situation, or if you have a ventilator, even FaceTime and help you with vent changes, et cetera, if needed, until the patient can be transferred. We certainly are more than welcome to, or happy to do that at CMC. If you call the transfer line, they'll put you in touch with one of our intensivists that are on call. And Dr. Quadge and Donna Marshall said they absolutely would be glad to help too. So please make sure that everybody's aware, and your colleagues that may not be on this call are aware, that if you do run into those situations, we'll be glad to help out. One question here is, when we discuss bed shortages, we are accounting for those beds that are being repurposed. Example, some OR recovery room beds are being converted into COVID beds. So that brings up a great point. And one of the discussions that I had with Dr. Slimp and Secretary Crouch a couple days ago is, if we had a unpredictable surge and we really needed infrastructure, what do we do? And my concern, again, was that the sick patients really need to be treated at the tertiary centers where you had the resources available. But in order to do that, you have to keep the bed flow going. And so, for example, here in Charleston, we have St. Francis. We have Charleston Medical, for example. There's places with infrastructure available. And to me, you would really want to make, instead of well facilities, you'd make them COVID facilities. Patients that are on the downhill side, they're no longer in the acute phase. They're more in the recovery phase. But since they can't go to a nursing home because the nursing home residents that are already there, the families are very, very worried about COVID patients coming in for obvious reasons. And so, but if you had a COVID unit where most of the patients, again, were more in that kind of swing bed status, they're all positive already, you'd have not as the nursing ratios wouldn't have to be so high, and it could probably be managed better. But when I talked to my colleagues in WVU and Marshall, they were concerned. Charleston would be a little more simple because you're only 5 minutes away from those other hospitals if they ever had to be employed. But Fairmont has been raised as a question, OBMC up north, other places, and they're really concerned about being spread too far too thin. And so I haven't had a chance to talk to Dr. Slimp yet, but they really felt that even if you had a MASH type unit sitting in the parking lot, or you repurposed some of the office buildings there right at Ruby, for example, or somewhere near the Marshall campus, they wanted those units close by. They agreed that it really probably should be more of the COVID step down swing units. But that's been some of the discussion. So anybody that has ideas, you've got Dr. Slim's ear. So, you know, please share those. And then another comment was here, also call your health department. That's another resource. I know Dr. Sherry Young here in the Kanawha County Health Department is doing an amazing job as always, but they're a great source of information too, if anybody has questions or needs other information. Here's a question. It says, how do those of us who are self-employed private offices apply PPE distribution? Is there any recommendations from the state to help private offices what they do with a very limited supply?
Yeah. So first thing in terms of accessing supply, I would talk to your local health department because that's where it's getting sent through to access it. And then there are guidelines around conservation strategies. I know, you know, some places, for instance, if they are seeing people called in, they know they're going to be seeing individuals that they are suspect to be COVID patients. They are clustering them at one end of the day, so you can have, you know, separate them from your routine patients, and then also conserve your PPE if you are evaluating them and testing. But there's other conservation strategies as well. But I would connect with your local health department related to access to PPE, because that's where we're kind of getting it through to the private sector providers.
And the only other thing I would add is that I know the Primary Care Association has passed along a burn rate calculator. So a lot of the problem or a lot of the information that is needed is how quickly do you use PPE? And it's different for everyone. And so if you can utilize the burn rate calculator, that can help determine how much does it need to be replenished. And we can start to get some trends. Now, obviously, if there's an outbreak or something, that might be a situation that you would burn through a little bit more of your PPE more quickly. But we're really encouraging practices to complete that burn rate calculator. It's through the CDC, and then that helps provide guidance to help project how much more we need to acquire over time.
Is that really, I think, you know, right now we're trying to get a lot, as much as we can, as we're going to acquire out to as many people as we can. But over time, there's going to have to be that kind of restock, resupply based on need. And so as much as you can help us understand that burn rate and that you can minimize that burn rate, the more we can flex it in communities. There's no possible way for me to allocate and know exactly who needs what all the time in every practice. So there's going to have to be some variation, some version of people really communicating within their community and kind of seeing who really needs it and how do you share it and how do you kind of do those resource sharing among yourselves so you can sustain a system. So it really will depend on how you do the healthcare system in your community as to where that need is. One of the things with long-term care, and it's been really interesting as we kind of investigate a few cases within long-term care facilities, both the Morgantown one and a couple of others that we've been looking at, you know, there's a lot of discussion of do you move the COVID-positive patient out of the nursing home, and we can do that. The issue becomes when someone tests negative, so you say they've been exposed and they test negative, that does not necessarily mean that they're going to be negative 3 or 4 days later, because that may be that they're incubating disease. And so I think we can't have this sense that you have to kind of assume that it's always potentially in your facility there. And so really what is critical, and for some of these patients, especially elderly, we were not seeing fevers initially, et cetera. They were pretty asymptomatic, some of them. But it could then get much worse. So I think the importance of good infection control in that facility, whether you have a high risk population, good infection control, including both PPE, but also the environmental administrative aspects of infection control are really, really important, especially if you're working with high risk groups in a closed setting. So.
Thank you very much. I have one quick question, Dr. Slim. So in terms of the thought process in terms of when practices will be able to get back up and running. That's something that everybody keeps asking me about. And my best answer right now is I don't think anybody really knows. We're going to have to continue to watch, I would imagine. But is there a guesstimate as to, depending on how we're watching the trends, what has to happen? Do we have to peak and start coming back down before things will start to be open back up? Or is there been any discussion on that?
Yeah, you know, you have got the $64,000 hot topic question. And I'll say a couple of things. And actually, first, let me go back to the projections you were having earlier. We saw the same ones this morning. I was looking at the West Virginia ones. There's another model similarly, but again, saying we might peak more again later in April. And they were looking at, a surge of kind of the low range being, around 2,800 patients, would be a low end of the surge, and about 7,200 patients being the higher end of the surge, estimate. So it's pretty widely variable. And I think, again, really, depends on how we are able to kind of really, mitigate now. So the question about when do you get back to normal? I mean, again, if that's the end of April, you might think by, you know, May or something, things are kind of petering down. But one of the things, this was just a call today with health officers, today and across the country. We're trying to wrestle with all of these, interventions and the community mitigation measures, and you're slowing down your practices and businesses are closed, and, you're always trying to balance the benefit and the risk of these things. And so it may be, and we also don't know that depending on how many folks may have been, infected and have some immunity through the wave, when you start to release them, release these mitigation measures, does it pop back up in your community? And there's some evidence that that can happen. And so it's possible that it's not simply a one wave goes through and then we, you know, you've got your mitigation measures in place and then you release them, versus it's possible that we end up having to think about a process in which we sort of gradually lift some that seem less effective at different times, and or less helpful, and ones that are more helpful, maintain them. And looking at the healthcare system capacity, you know, we're always trying to keep the healthcare system stable. So we maybe have to look at, and this could be community by community around states, you know, the healthcare, what's the healthcare system capabilities at that point to handle a little bit more surge if it comes up again? What is the public health infrastructure for doing that case contact investigation, outbreak management piece at that time? What's our testing capability at that time? And what's the impacts of the mitigation measures? Is it worse versus better? What's the cost benefit ratio or the risk benefit ratio? So we could also foresee a possibility, and this is all in the kind of discussion phase of sort of ebbs and flows that try to sustain economy and try to sustain healthcare system and try to minimize health impact as we learn more. For instance, there's some early evidence, and many things feed into that. There's some early evidence that, and we're going to find out more, that elderly tend to shed virus more than young, potentially. And so we have to look at and understand that more to see what's the role of school closures in that setting. And so if that turns out to be, we don't have this evidence yet, but if that turns out to be, less of a benefit and more of a challenge to communities because it's keeping people out of the healthcare workforce and other essential, settings, maybe we need to think about releasing that one versus other ones at different times. So this is a lot of debate around the country, and we don't know exactly what we'll see.
I know I was looking at the CD website, and they were saying, because the other question had been posed to me several times is, if someone has already been infected, you know, can they be reinfected? And I know there are some things you hear that has been seen a couple times. I know the CDC, though, is saying on their website that once you've been infected and you've recovered, and after quarantine, you're good. So in terms of, let's say, for example, a healthcare worker, an intensivist or any such. Once they're positive, has the state got any guidelines as to when the physician can return back to duty?
Yeah, there is guidance around healthcare worker return to work. And there's guidance that is both the ideal, and there's also guidance that is if your healthcare workforce is entirely really short and you have to get somebody back earlier, how do you practically adapt that? I don't know if you posted it on the website yet. I'll try to make sure we do or get it to you so you can disseminate it. Cause that's a key piece with that. And you're absolutely right. We'll get that out to you.
Yeah. We had a meeting last night. Of course, there are 7 intensivists in my group. And so we try to run through the scenario. What happens when, because most likely through this, our group, we all feel there's a high likelihood we're all going to be positive at some point. So we're just trying to figure that one out ourselves is when you could go back. Because my understanding, too, is in flu, for example, in the hospital, our policy is from the time of diagnosis, 7 days, and unless you're having fevers, you're not considered to be in droplet precautions, et cetera, anymore. But that's not the case with COVID because you can still be shedding even out at 10 days. That's right.
Well, the recommendation right now for like home isolation with COVID is that you need to stay home for 7 days after the onset of symptoms. And at least 3 days after fever resolution off of antipyretics. So the minimum time that you would be out would be 7 days. If you have fever up to day 5 or 6, then you'd extend that longer, so you'll until you are 3 days after fever resolution off of any kind of antipyretics with that. So that's the standard when you release someone back to work with COVID-19. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we can, Danny, work on that. And just because I'm sure all the physicians on here is going to have similar questions as we go through and learn more over the next week or something, maybe get some recommendations out because they're going to have to give all this information to their patients, and when they're coming back positive and after quarantine, they're going to be asking when they can return to work, especially if they're essential people that are still working right now.
And that's actually on the website now. There are handouts that if you're testing someone for COVID-19, that means to us that you're suspicious enough that they have it, that they should manage it as if it is COVID-19. And so there is a handout about if you are a suspect or a confirmed case of COVID-19, and it gives that guidance of when to come back to work. And again, it's that 7 days after onset, hi Sherry, 7 days after onset, and at least 3 days after fever resolution.
Hi.
So there's a handout on that. There's a handout on that, on the website. And, actually we sent it out through an email to all healthcare providers,
the dear colleague
letter. It has it in that as well. There's also one on if you've been exposed, mm-hmm. if you think you've been exposed to COVID-19, what to do with that.
Dr. Sherry Young with Kanawha County Health Department just joined in, or at least we got a video feed. You may have been with us all along. I don't know. But
I was actually on a couple of other calls. I'm glad to hear that you guys are meeting and talking about the issues. Dr. Slemp is our subject matter expert on the public health issue, and then to have Dr. Tom Takubo, our star pulmonologist, thank you both so much for reaching out and for all the work you're doing. You're both on the front lines, and I can't thank you enough every day. We're working hard here at Health Commands, and I don't know if anybody – you two are a very difficult act to follow, so I don't know if I have anything to add, but I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody has any.
I think we have questioned out. So there's one question was who when their offices have some questions, who at the Kanawha County Health Department should they direct those calls to?
The best line to access us 24 hours a day. We have set up a hotline, several volunteers. It's 1-304-348-1088. And we have four dedicated staff during the day and night answering questions at all times, anything about COVID. And if it's something that they can't answer, they come and get one of us. So best number to call.
Well, thank you, everyone. Does anybody else on the call have anything else to add?
Hey, Dr. Takubo, this is Danny. For those of you that are just listening, I just want to tell you that on top of the DHHR website, which is coronavirus.dhhr.gov, our website, WVSMA.org, we've placed a bunch of things on the website so that any person can look at them. So we put them in front of the login so that any practitioner, not just state medical members, could take a look at that. And if they do have questions and they want to reach, whether it's you or Dr. Young or any of the folks that are on here, they can send an email to info@wvsma.org, and we've been collecting those emails and passing them on to the right people and answering questions as necessary. We'll also be having other town hall call, virtual town halls like this throughout the coming weeks, as many as we need to have. So we really appreciate your time and coming on. Thank you.
Danny?
We have one more thing to add. It's yes. A new thing that we just learned on the call Dr. Slim's going to share with the rest of the crowd. We just learned on the national health officer call.
All my colleagues around the country. Interestingly, and we haven't fully evaluated this yet, but it's an interesting tool that I'm hearing out about, and we'll maybe put it up if it's appropriate to do so. AFL, interestingly, has come out with a Get COVID-19 Guidance app. And it includes an assessment for testing. Do you or do you not need testing for that? It incorporates that into it. And so it's an app that you can either download from the Apple Store or from the Google Play Store. And then it's also a web-based one. So we're going to take a look at that and just see if that helps people walk through it to understand the issues more and to kind of guide them through evaluation and linking to your healthcare provider appropriately and those kinds of things. So just another, there are interesting things evolving that you might look at and see what you think about that and see if that's something that you would find helpful for your patients.
Yeah. Dr. Slamp, as always, thank you so much. Danny, everybody can get CME. I know everything's kind of shut down. Some conferences may be getting shut down. So if you spent your Friday afternoon, you had nothing better to do than spend a little bit of time with all of us listening to this, you can at least get some CME. And I think you have something set up. How do they get their CME time?
All they have to do is reach out to Heather at info@wvsma.org. And we'll need your name, your organization. Heather, is there anything else they need?
No. That's all.
Right. While we're talking about that, Doc, Jay Ripley, I know, was on the call earlier, and I don't know if he's still on or not, but CAMC's helped us with CME, and right now the ACCME and CAMC have been working to rapidly get us credit for some of these types of events. I really, really want to say that I appreciate them and the help that they've given us, considering that conferences and meetings are canceled all throughout the country.
Yeah, hopefully we can keep this going in the future for just general information, and it's been a great tool. I don't know why we haven't used it more. Well, for the good of business, any further questions or concerns or comments or statements, if you think of it afterward, just make sure you email Danny, and I'm sure he can disseminate all that back out to us. So thanks, everybody, and we appreciate it, and stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.